Hey everybody, welcome into the back room. I'm Andy Ostroy. We have author Katie Rogers on the show today. We're going to get to Katie in a second. But first, thanks for tuning in. We appreciate you listening and we'd love to hear your comments. So email us at backroomandy@gmail.com and or post on our social media and we'll read some feedback next time. And if you like the podcast, please rate and review and follow or subscribe and you'll be notified every time we post a new episode. So, Katie Rogers, she is a White House correspondent for the New York Times, where she has worked since 2014. She's traveled the world covering two presidential administrations, writing extensively about domestic policy, foreign policy, and the complicated dynamics of first families. Her just-published first book is American Woman, The Transformation of the Modern First Lady, from Hillary Clinton to Jill Biden. Katie, welcome into the back room.
Thank you for having me.
Very excited to talk with you. Your book is American Woman, The Transformation of the Modern First Lady, from Hillary Clinton to Jill Biden. What a contrast in some of those ladies, by the way, which I'm really looking forward to talking
Not to
with.
Mention a mouthful of a title.
Well, you know, isn't that most books these days have the title and then they have
long
the subtitle and it's just a long subtitle. But before we get into all that stuff, tell me a little bit about you and your background, where you grew up, what kind of family were they? Political, and when did you first sort of get bitten by the politics bug and thinking about being a writer? How early did that start?
That's so funny. It's such a long answer to a very good question. But I actually grew up, I was born in South Bend, Indiana, and grew up in Elkhart, which is right outside of the town where you're not familiar. It's Northern Indiana. It's where Notre Dame is, and Pete Buttigieg is from South Bend, and he kind of popularized that area. So I'm actually from a pretty conservative, my dad's side is, my dad, you know, worked for Dick Lugar when he was an intern in the 80s.
Wow.
My great uncle was chair of the Republican Party in Indiana at one point. I kind of grew up in a different generation of the Republican Party, I think, than I think that if any of those relatives were alive now, I'm not sure that they would recognize what their party is.
So when you say their party, does that mean you're not conservative or where are you today?
I mean, I don't think I subscribe. It's funny because the more you report and write and the longer I go, you know, into this field, like the more just very, I know this is probably not a satisfactory answer, but the more moderate middle of the road, I feel like I've become, you know, like I felt maybe one way when I was in college. And I always think I didn't quite fit where I grew up. I guess I could just say it that way, with my views. Anyway, I grew up and I was really interested in writing from a young age. I had this newsletter in middle school that was sort of like a gossip column, really. I was like a muckraker from pretty early on. And I didn't recognize that as journalism, but I went to college in Chicago. I started interning and getting clips for the Tribune came back to my hometown and worked for 2 years as an education reporter, then went to Northwestern for grad school. This was like during the recession. Got a job in Washington running a Twitter account at the Washington Post. So really like the politics bug didn't, I never was interested in covering politics really. I was like a local news education beat reporter. I loved feature writing. I loved profiles. Like I just have that sensibility. Fast forward, I had jobs at the Post, at the Guardian, when they launched their New York newsroom, doing breaking news and social media, got hired at the Times on the overnight shift to do sort of a news app and then a breaking news desk. And then they kind of noticed I could do features and I had a front page story about the Trump inauguration performers. And they were like, yeah, this one can do features and she writes fast and let's move her to Washington for a few months and write about the dawn of the Trump administration in Washington. This very conservative administration of outsiders sort of coming to this heavily Democratic city. And so I wrote stories about like how, you know, protesting became the new brunch and people posting on Craigslist for roommates that didn't want to live with Trump voters, and sort of like the dawn of what that looked like. And then they just kept, they kept me here. And I got put on the White House team a year in. So I covered all of the Trump administration, but as a White House reporter formally since 2018. So it kind of found me, and I still don't think I look at politics in the same way a lot of Washington reporters do. I tend to just look at it through personalities and personal dynamics, and sort of I try to find out as much as I can about the inner lives of the people making the decisions. I think like the story about the president, like the man as president, is the most interesting thing to me, like how this human being sort of navigates the most, you know, powerful job in the world at this time in our history. And it was fascinating to do it when Donald Trump had that role, and it's fascinating to do it with Joe Biden having that role. And it's actually harder to report on the Biden administration, I think, because it's such an insular group of people. So when you get a good story, it's like, it feels like a win. Anyway, long answer to your question, but that's the story of me in a nutshell.
So the idea for this book, it's really a great subject. And, you know, in putting it together, you went through published memoirs and biographies. You interviewed over 125 people, including Joe Biden and her associates and other White House aides and staffers, past and present. What made you decide to write about the first ladies?
I just am drawn to them. And one of the things I guess I didn't say in my very long answer the first time is that I think I became interested in them actually back in college. I did a freelance assignment for the school paper, I remember, and it was writing about this exhibit at the Field Museum. It was about Jacqueline Kennedy and her fashion. It was curated by Vogue. It had been at the Met in New York first. And it was all about how this educated, sophisticated woman used style to sort of further diplomacy abroad, but also bring Americans into the White House. So there's one example of her visiting Paris and upstaging President Kennedy. And he kind of says, I'm the man who accompanied her to Paris. And at the time, she got the French to send the Mona Lisa abroad to us so Americans could see it. And I just remember thinking, even back then, over 20 years ago, like, that's power, you know? It's not soft power. It's not feminine power. It's actually messaging, and it's political. And it was in service of a culturally enriching American life. And I don't know, I've just always been interested in how they use the power they have and the platform they have to do things like that, but also their influence with their husbands, their tendency to be a protector of their husbands and the keeper of the grudges and the keeper of the secrets. And I feel like they're so underestimated in that sense. People tend to think of them as like, you know, the ones who pick the china and the ones who organize the guest list. And they do have, you know, they do have control over that. But they're also often the ones who are they vet the people who get closest to the president. And if they don't like those people and don't trust them, you know, in Joe Biden's case, for sure, you know, those people are not, they don't last long in that orbit. So I just find them fascinating, and I think they're powerful.
Well, if you look at first ladies, like just in the last 65 years, if you go from Jackie Kennedy and then go to Hillary Clinton, and then you go to Melania Trump and then swing back with Joe Biden, like they are so different. Has there been some inherent evolution to the role? And if so, how do you think the role of the first lady has changed in the context of your book from Hillary Clinton on, or even going back further to like Jackie Kennedy? Because if there has been so much, so if there has been so much change, you know, then we had Melania Trump, which kind of feels like it's set all that back.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, I don't think it did set things back in a way. I actually think, you know, and I thought Melania Trump, and I think Donald Trump, you know, is a civic lesson. If you look at the way that he showed Americans what is a norm and what is a law, you know, it was almost like a demented schoolhouse rock in a way, watching Trump sort of break through a lot of these barriers. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, in a very different way, Melania Trump illuminated expectations around the role. And I actually didn't know this when I started reporting on her. I didn't actually know that there are no rules for the first lady. Like, you don't have to do anything. And I guess I had always just assumed that there was like a blueprint, or, you know, here's what you do. And there's certainly tradition, but there's no hard and fast rules to how you do it. And actually having her unravel that and just not show up for weeks at a time, not move to Washington for the first half of the first year of the presidency, you know, slapping her husband's hand away in public, sending tweets that were, you know, opposite of what he would say about things like Charlottesville, that horrible rally in Charlottesville, mm-hmm. when he said people, there are great people on both sides, or good people on both sides. And she actually, you know, said, stop, let's end the violence. Is, you know, she was actually the opposite of what he was saying in those times. And so I think you could actually argue that having somebody like Melania Trump makes it easier for the next person, who is Jill Biden, to come in and say, look, I know nobody's ever kept a job as first lady before. I would like to keep my job. I'll do it 2 days a week, but the rest of the time I want to be first lady, you know? And basically everybody was pretty cool with that. Like, mm-hmm. she got more criticism about wanting to be called doctor, I think, than wanting to go back to her job. But just to go back to your initial question, I think there is this stair step where each person's experience informs the next. And I think Hillary Clinton was such an interesting bookend to start with for this book, because she had such ambition for the role and approached it. You know, Eleanor Roosevelt is a hero of hers, and approached it almost as if she could take that sort of standard bearer. You know, Eleanor Roosevelt delivered her own press conferences and had her own press corps and traveled and spoke on behalf of her husband. And, you know, Hillary Clinton thought that she could do much the same, except take that further and have a policy goal, which was reforming healthcare. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Clintons really did believe that their election was a mandate for change and pushing Americans forward. And Hillary Clinton would find during her tenure that Americans were not necessarily ready for a first lady to come in and be like, I'm not going to just stay home and bake cookies. I have a job. You know, I am unequal. President Clinton said, you know, essentially Americans would be getting two for the price of one. So having her, you know, in politics, they call it scar tissue, and having her accumulate this scar tissue of having to push too hard and finding the limits of that really set the tone for every first lady that has come after her in terms of really ambitious policy goals. Some of them have been on the Hill, you know, testifying for various, Laura Bush had done that for education. But none of them have really tried as hard as Hillary Clinton did to push major policy initiatives, in part because of how explosive Hillary's tenure was. Mm-hmm. So they're all so different, but they certainly take cues from each other.
In terms of the partnership role the First Lady serves, I mean, we've seen it over the years, like how Nancy Reagan was Ron's partner, Michelle was Barack's partner in her own mm-hmm. way, Laura Bush was George's partner. But Hillary seems to have taken that to a next level kind of definition, right? Like, they were real, true strategic partners. Was she the most engaged first lady on a political strategic level ever?
I think, you know, one of the most. She had her own office in the West Wing, which, you know, was called Hillary Land, and had her own little cadre of aides there. So in that sense, geographically, she was incredibly close to the Oval, and wanted to sort of step over from the East Wing and make it very clear that her world was in the West Wing as well. But in terms of politically engaged and strategic, I think Jill Biden is actually, I don't know, one of the most, if not the most political of all of them, because mm-hmm. I think the role has become such that it is seen as, you know, very linked to the messaging that comes out of the West Wing, very linked to the initiatives that the president is undertaking. And the first year, you know, I think we're all like collectively coming out of the trauma that was the pandemic still. But like, if you remember that first year, you know, she might have had policy goals, but really the biggest goal was to get shots into arms. And to, once the vaccine came out, she was the one who was traveling all over the country and holding people's hands as they got the shots. And basically part of this very fulsome effort to help end the horror that was this pandemic. And that's political messaging, and it was very refined, and it was formally done, and it was done in lockstep with the West Wing. And now flash forward to the reelect effort. She's on a 3-day swing, I think, starting now, to raise money for him. She traveled for President Biden. She travels, I think, more than any other principal, doing fundraisers. She's an enormously popular surrogate. She is a huge draw for grassroots funding. So that's always super an important indicator of popularity, viability, when you have small dollar donors, and she attracts those people. So she might not have an office in the West Wing, but she is incredibly involved in everything the political operation is doing, because they need her and they want her to be out there speaking on behalf of the president.
And they've also had like a 50-year political marriage, right? Yeah. It's almost like there's a symmetry and a symbiotic aspect to how they approach the day.
Yep.
That the others.
No one's
have.
Had more practice.
Yeah.
Yeah. No one has had more practice than the two of them and her as a political spouse. She spent 8 years as second lady too, you know? And one of the things I'm really interested in seeing if the Bidens win another term is how she'll be when she doesn't have to campaign or run, you know, but she will still speak on his behalf, but she won't have that. They won't be running for anything anymore. That will truly be, you know, it'll be an interesting second term if they get one, both for him, but also for her. Mm-hmm.
Since Hillary, what would you say are the best and worst first lady moments?
Oh, gosh. Well, hands down, I think the worst was when Melania Trump wore that I really don't care to you jacket when she went on a trip to Texas to visit migrant children.
Even worse than the I don't give a fuck about the Christmas stuff. Worse than that?
I think so. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Just the dissonance
bad
of that,
messaging,
right?
No.
You know, it was right after she had, you know, her husband, former President Trump, had given her public credit for his decision to end family separation. And Melania Trump is a European born. She's the second first lady in our history to have been born abroad. She is a naturalized citizen. There's been a lot of scrutiny around that, of course, and you
the
know
Einstein
the process
visa.
So but the fact that she'd been given public credit for doing that and, you know, urging her husband to stop this, and then days later she goes to a shelter and has a strange, stunning message on her back that she has, you know, explained as, you know, saying it was about the media. She was messaging to the media. You know, it comes out later in a book by her former communications director, Stephanie Grisham, that Trump had told them, you know, this is going to be the story. This is going to be the explanation. So you don't really ever have a story why she did that. I had heard it was about her stepdaughter Ivanka, but like really, it was
tone deaf,
puzzling. It still is weird. It's one of the strangest things that I saw covering that. And you saw a lot of strange things covering that White House, but the dissonance of that was really strange. And the best moments, I mean, I think they all have their really great moments. You know, Hillary Clinton's speech from Beijing about women's rights was sort of a capstone of her time. Laura Bush, in a lot of different ways, became a wartime first lady and sort of the nation's mother around a national tragedy, taking over her husband's radio address and just really being sort of the president becomes the consoler in chief, and he had a very tumultuous tenure, left very unpopular, but she was very popular when she left compared to him. And Michelle Obama became sort of a cultural force and a cultural icon. People couldn't get enough of, you know, everything about her. She, you know, Jen Psaki, who's a former Biden press secretary, also worked in the Obama White House, told me, you know, she made this cool. She made the act of being first lady cool. And that is a great thing. It became a cultural, you know, phenomenon. Beyonce was at the White House, you know. Melania Trump, you know, I think she was never more human and never more, you know, she was at her best when she would, you know, visit shelters for children born with opioid addiction, and, you know, do the thing like hold the babies and talk to the families and shed light on the opioid epidemic within our country. Unfortunately, a lot of what she did was undercut by either her behavior or her husband. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she was at her best. She was also at her best when she organized state dinners, you know, the state dinner for President Macron of France. That was a good moment for her. And then Jill Biden, again, I think being sort of the emissary during the pandemic, you know, of not encouraging people to get this vaccine, meeting with educators and talking to them about reopening schools and what was being lost when children were kept away from school. They all have their moments. It's hard to say that there is a best one. I'm like racking my brain, but
That's good. No, that was pretty enlightening, I'd say.
Yeah.
First ladies typically adopt projects that face limited opposition, such as education and literacy and fitness and supporting the military, military families, anti-bullying. Melania had Be Best. And a lot of people didn't really understand just even grammatically what the hell that meant. Like, did that even exist? What was it? And did it actually do anything? Was there any substance and results to it and from it?
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, I just think that so much of what she tried with her platform, which she named, by the way, she drew the logo for it. So this was a Melania Trump production through and through. She had advisors early on. She had one in particular. Her name is Stephanie Winston-Wolkoff. She is a New Yorker. Mm-hmm. She was sort of brought down as an informal advisor and left, about a year and a half in, maybe not even that far. But she had privately pushed Melania for, you know, for a platform that would involve social and emotional learning, like something very straightforward and formalized, you know, to help kids in schools. And Melania ended up deciding she wanted to do sort of a three-pronged approach, but mostly focused on online bullying and child welfare, like very blanket, like broad, you know, topics. And immediately was criticized because of her husband's online behavior, which is, you know, not a model for online safety, to put it lightly. So I think, you know, she tried, but they undercut the efforts because of what was coming out of that White House every day. She would have events where she would spotlight kids who had been bullied or kids who had tried innovative new things in their school to like help other kids or things like that. But results wise, policy wise, no, she didn't accomplish a lasting change through her efforts. No.
This may be a tough question for you to answer. I'm 64, so I've lived through a lot of first ladies.
Yeah.
And I think all the first ladies that I've ever known, they seem like good people. Is Melania Trump a good person, or is she like her husband and not a good person?
Well, I think unless there are extreme examples, I think everybody has elements of good and bad in them. And I think in her case, sometimes she had good intentions. Sometimes she wanted to be seen as separate from her husband and setting her own path. And, you know, her former aides told me she really liked being separate from him. It was the first time that she
Can you blame her?
Could have. It was the first time she had her own staff and she had a barrier and a buffer. And she would say, we do our own thing here. And actually toward the end of Trump's presidency, after he lost, you know, she began sort of shutting down, is how it was described to me, because she had to go back and live with him again. And she was losing that barrier and losing that staff. And so I think that there was, you know, in that relationship, there were, you know, tensions and complications that she could get away from as first lady, to be honest. And at least that's what my reporting shows. But in terms of being like her husband or unlike her husband, all first ladies channel their husbands, I think, because it is a partnership. And she shares a lot of his grievances. She urges him as much as, you know, the Charlottesville tweet, you know, mm-hmm. urging people to stop was a moment for her. There are more examples of her privately urging her husband to fight back if she felt he had been attacked. So she is a very, you know, it's almost prideful in the way that she thinks about this, is like, they're attacking our family, they're attacking our name. Are you going to let them do that?
Right.
So I don't know if it's good or bad, but it certainly mirrors him.
Well, there, you know, when they first started out, there was a lot of people were like in the free Melania camp. And then that kind of changed after a while. It was like, you know what? She doesn't need to be freed. She's complicit.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Or she likes the safety of that lifestyle. It's a privileged lifestyle. Mm-hmm. That is what she has known since she has been with him, mm-hmm. you know, sort of being ensconced in a gilded tower, you know? And in a lot of ways, the White House is an even more, you know, ensconced. Mm-hmm. It is an even more ensconced environment. And I do think you're right. You know, that first year, it was sort of like I call it sort of a fever dream that people thought she was like a secret resistance figure. And she's not, and she wasn't. And it'll be interesting, though, to see what she does when the campaign progresses and Trump begins to take a lot more heat, as I think he will, because Democrats are really galvanizing around reproductive rights, mm-hmm. women's rights. And he needed her in 2016 after that Access Hollywood tape. He needed her to go to swing states right before the election and say, my husband loves everybody. You know, he might say one thing, but this is what's in his heart. And it will be interesting to see if she comes out again and is called upon to pull him out of a self-created maelstrom.
Well, you're right that she's the reluctant first lady. And I can't imagine that she is not as reluctant as ever. Like, that woman does not want to go back to that White House, I don't think, you know.
I think, you know, people around her say she'd absolutely be first lady again. But the idea of coming back to Washington seems way more of a gray area than I would have expected when I began, you know, reporting that part. So, you know, it's conceivable that she finds a way to be a commuting first lady, you know. I don't know what she'll do, but I certainly have picked that up in terms of, like, she'd like the title, but maybe not the life in Washington again. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the resistor thing. I had a very fun viral moment years ago. Do you remember the video where, I think it was maybe the inauguration or somewhere, where he turned around, looked at her, she smiled, and when he turned back, she scowled, right?
Yeah.
So I took that video. I took that video and I tweeted, the only wall that Donald Trump seems to have built is the one between him and Melania. She liked that tweet. It was the only...
Did she?
Yes. It was only the second time...
From her FLOTUS account? Or her
from
private?
Her FLOTUS account. And within 45 minutes, she took it down. And it became... It was everywhere. I mean, Jimmy Fallon, it was his opening joke. It was on CNN, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times. It was unbelievable. It was so much fun. But years later, I've had Stephanie Grisham on here a bunch of times. And I asked her, I said, so were you the press secretary when that happened? She goes, oh, yeah. And she sort of gave me the behind the scenes. And it was Melania. It was, of course, it was Melania, you know?
Oh, wow.
But
she's a total Twitter, you know, upset. She just like her husband used to be. She's on Twitter all the time.
It was a crazy moment. But you're right. It will be interesting to see what happens this year, because it's going to be a crazy 8 months. But I do hope you'll come back and talk with me again, because there's so much we're leaving on the table that I'd love to talk with you about.
Totally.
So we'd love to have you back.
And I hope someday you or I get to ask her about the favoriting of that tweet. I mean, I hope it's you. But aren't you just dying to like just ask her?
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, they claim that like it was an aide, it was this, it was a mistake, it was that. But my theory is they just had a fight of some sort. And she was like, fuck him. Boom. Like that tweet. And then like it blew up.
I don't think Inauguration Day was a good day for her. We can talk about that the next time.
You know what? We could talk about her and him for hours and hours. But I really don't think there's ever a good day between her and him for her. She is not only the reluctant first lady, she's the reluctant wife. That's my theory.
I think there are good hours in the days, though. I'm just not sure.
Maybe when she's out shopping, then she's like, I love Donald. When she's about to charge
more
something.
More to come.
But, yeah. Take care, Katie. It's been fun. Good luck with the book.
Thank you
for
having me.
The book again is American Woman, The Transformation of the Modern First Lady, from Hillary Clinton to Joe Biden. You can get it everywhere you buy your books. It is a great book. It's really fascinating. And so is The Office of the First Lady. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Take care. Bye.
This episode of The Back Room was edited and produced by me, Andy Ostroy. It was co-edited and co-produced by Maddie Rosenberg and co-produced by Jen Hammoud. Our theme song was composed by Andrew Hollander, and our logo was designed by Cricket Langell. And special thanks to Patricia Wind. Please take a moment to rate and review the podcast, and also follow or subscribe. Until next time, keep your eyes on Washington, Hollywood, and your own backyards, and have a great week.